ready to explain the electrifying reasons why we're sitting there a review, if you like. I know it's called something else, but a review of the decision to strike out part of our submission. So, would you like to start now?
Yeah, well, I'll just formally open. We do record these hearings just so that we've got
a record. You're all from the council.
Yes, so we'll do we'll do some introductions. So I'll formally open the hearing. So thank you for coming along to speak to your. So this is actually an objection hearing under section 357.
That's correct. So originally filed by Vance, but he was overseas at the time, and so I've just been helping as we go along. I'm an ex-prisoner of AOVA.
Oh, I see. So you're just to come
and an owner. To join the association, you have to be an owner of a private.
Okay. Right. Yes, I see you represent 900.
Yeah, I know a lot of equity.
Private agencies throughout New Zealand. So that's good. So so I'm Jane Taylor. So I'm the commissioner. I've got a legal background by training, and I've been a commissioner for an independent commissioner for QLBC since. About 2006, thereabouts. So, but these kinds of appeals are because we've just been through a district plan process, these are probably a novel thing for us here. So we're just getting to that stage in the process where you are getting submissions being struck out and then subsequently being appealed. So because of that, we actually have. From QLBC, Heidi Bailey, who is a senior solicitor with QLBC, sitting here. And we also have Ian Bayliss, who's the planning policy manager as well. And our committee secretary is Hope Larson, who's in the here. So, any other questions before we start?
No, fine, thanks.
All right, thank you. Well, if you could...
Thank you, the council for... accommodating us with this hearing, and thank you, Commissioner, for agreeing to listen to us. Just a wee bit of background. As a local member of the Aircraft Owners and Pilots Association, I was given a task which we thought would be a relatively quick and simple one back in about 3 years ago now to represent the association and look after our interests in terms of the planning process which was underway at that stage as the proposed district plan. So I've been driving that, but as my friend George Tapper here has alluded to, some of the proceedings that have taken place along the way have been at times that I've been out in the country. So Jules, as a very long-standing member and a long-standing aviator, I think 40 years or so, something like 58 years, there we are, agreed very kindly to step in to keep the process flowing while I was away. I guess that the situation we find ourselves in today, we think is actually, what it's all boiled down, is actually quite a simple situation. It can be made to be very complicated.
Yes.
As can all things I've discovered to do with planning, and I've discovered that more as each stage has gone on. But in essence, it is very simple. What happened with the planning process was, of course, that in 2015 in August, it was signalled to the community by a number of means, including this proposed district plan notice and notices of the paper that the council was proposing to review the district plan. People would have an opportunity to make submissions on the proposals. And as far back as this document in August 15, it was signalled in the content of that part of that planning process will be to look at what the council called informal airports, which in layman's terms boil down to places where you could land or take off from a helicopter or fixed wing aircraft.
Right. So not designated airports, but just people. Essentially private blocks of land that you could land that would be big enough to accommodate.
Not necessarily within the facilities, but any sort of associated with it.
So it could be just a private landowner who owned your own helicopter, for example.
Yeah.
We do have a number around here.
Yeah.
So what's been happening over the years is that, I mean, if we go back 30 years, the density of housing and development in the district was obviously a lot less than it is now.
Yes.
And a number of our members owned aircraft or had friends who owned aircraft, and they were used to being able to land for a cup of tea at someone's house, assuming that you met all the safety requirements, and that's the policy description, or to, in some cases, be able to keep your aircraft at your house, and so on. And I won't go into what council's view on that was, but need to say it wasn't clear-cut, but it was a long-term practice. And then we realised in August 15 that it was proposed to clarify, shall we say, by including in the district plan what the proposals were. So, obviously, there was a whole range of issues that were involved with the district plan,
mm-hmm.
and at that stage, it's also important, I think, to realise that in August 15, and indeed right up until 2017, the rural area, which is what most people were wanting to operate to and from,
yes.
encompassed not only the area right out through, say, up to the Branches Station, Menwickburn, those far-reaching areas, Menorkey and beyond, but also encompassed the area which probably was of sort of semi-rural density, such as around the Wanaka, Lake Hawea, and also the rural parts of the Wakatipu Basin. So all of that was wrapped up into rural. So what happened then was that obviously there was a lot of discussion and interest amongst aircraft operators about what this might mean, and the association through me made submissions on the proposed district plan as it was then, which encompassed the Wakatipu, and a number of our members made submissions on a private basis as well, including here Mr. Tapper,
right.
And that's relevant because although I, for whatever reason, didn't receive some subsequent notifications, Mr. Tapper did, and we'll sort of discuss later the relevance that he attached to those and that other members attached to those. So the end result was, or not the end result, one of the next results was that around about, it's a bit hard to determine, but it seems somewhere between 20 and 30 persons made submissions on the proposed district plan for the rural district,
yes.
And that was back in, from memory, late 2015.
Yes.
And we made those proposals with the belief that our submissions related to the Wakatipu Basin as well.
Right. So that was stage one, wasn't it?
That was stage one, correct.
Yes. And so when those hearings were held, you were represented at that and submitted on those to the panel. Is that right at that time?
When
the stage one hearings were held, you appeared and submitted.
Correct.
Yes.
Yeah, there was, I think from memory, there were six or seven individual people like myself, plus the people, but you know the numbers
right.
there.
Right.
And so we made submissions at a hearing. We were heard. We thought satisfactorily,
yes.
And then eventually we saw a decision on stage one.
Yes.
And part of our submissions related not just to the rules, but they related to the associated standards that goes with those rules. And in
yes.
the standards,
yes.
It was stated that where you interplace you were to land or take off as a right would have to be, in simple terms, 500 metres from the notional boundary of any adjacent residence. And,
yes.
Or road or boundary.
Or road or boundary in most days.
And
when the decision came out, the road part had been dropped out and we were left with the 500 metres from any residence.
Right, okay. Well, that was actually one of my questions around that 500 metre rule. So we might come back to that. We'll, hear you through first and then we'll come back to...
Although it's not the purpose of the hearing today to discuss the merits of that, I need to allude a little bit to it so you can understand the process, but
yes.
What happened then was it was realised by the association and our members and and other submitters generally, that it was really very difficult to comply with 500 metres. It sounds like it's not very far, but if you actually have a look around the Wakatipu Basin and the Wanaka area, it's very difficult to find a place where you're right to land which is not within 500 metres of another place. To do that, you really need to go right out to the areas I touched on before, like the branches here in Shire, Albert Byrne Valleys, things like that. So what happened was that it was felt that we had a situation where council had in its wisdom decided to give us, and the commissioners decided to give us a concession, as it were, to do this thing, but in reality it wasn't of any great use because it was not possible to find the 500 metres. And we're not arguing about that today, it's just setting up the facts.
So when you say give a concession, that was the permitted activity
schedule? Yes, permitted activity, that's right. It's not sure within the 500 metres of... And there were some other restrictions, like a number of bandits per day, can be no more than two, and things like that.
Yes.
But generally speaking, the 500 metres was the thing that got people thinking. And as a result of that, we filed an appeal. And to file an appeal, because it had got to a stage at that point that the complexity of the process was a little beyond lay people like ourselves, we involved legal counsel to file the appeal for us.
So that appeal, just to clarify, make sure I'm getting this right, the appeal was against the Stage 1 decision.
Against the Stage 1, yes. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Stage 1.
And now, so where is that process now? Then?
Sorry?
Where is that process?
The appeal's moving towards mediation, which is the favoured method of trying to resolve appeals or arrange the appeals. And at the moment it's set down for, as Mr Tapper says, I believe for March. It's a tentative date. So there's a mediator that's been appointed to try to move that process on without everybody having to go to the expense of the full environment court hearing. So that's where that's at. When we instructed solicitors, which for the appeal, which from memory was back in June of this year, it became apparent from their conversation with us that the Wakatipu Basin was actually no longer part of what we had submitted on. In other words, we thought when we made the submissions back in 2015-16 that we were submitting on a whole rural area, but it turned out that the Wakatipu had been taken out of the general rural area and split into two separate areas, one being called the Rural Amenity Zone, and one being called the Lifestyle Precinct, and there's a map here which is not coloured proper. But basically, the dark area is the precinct, and the light area is the Rural Amenity Zone.
Thank you, that's him, because I didn't pull down any maps, actually.
It became further apparent during our discussions with our solicitors this year that council's intention was that everybody should have submitted again
on this new concept.
Wakatipu, whereas we were under the misapprehension, as it transpires, we're pretty much all of the other submitters who made the original submissions on the rural side. We were under the misapprehension that the original submissions we made covered the whole of the rural zone, because we felt that as lay people, which we were, and that seems to be where the Act originally was scoped toward, that as lay people we would be advised if in some way our submissions were no longer relevant and being told, guys, you need to make some more submissions. And we thought so that none of us picked up on that, and we were suddenly left with a situation where we had submissions which we thought we'd made for the Wakatipu no longer valid, but they were valid for the rural zone and they'd gone to appeal. But here we were with the Wakatipu, which obviously is very important and more populous area, which we had no chance to make submissions on because we had, I guess from council's perspective, missed the boat.
Right.
Now the next thing that happened was we were advised by our solicitors, and I think it was about July, maybe shortly later, we advised in August that council had made a mistake in the documentation of the Wakatipu proposed district plan, which we had been unaware existed, but we were made aware that it did exist. And as a result of that mistake, they had left out what they intended to apply with regard to informal airports, as they call them, for the rural lifestyle precinct.
Right, and there's that rule, the rule, got a copy of it here. That was the table, wasn't it? That was left.
Yes, it was a table.
Table 2.2.
And it was, yes. So the table had been missed out, and the rural lifestyle precinct was re-advertised and submissions were called for. Now, our legal advice was that because it was felt that the standards, which were the which go, if you like, with you need to read the standards with the rules.
Yes.
Because the standards were the thing that we were concerned about, because that was the standards that contained the 500 metres,
yes.
That they were linked, and that therefore it would be appropriate for us to make a submission to try to get our voice heard on the from our point of view with regard to the Waikato Basin, and that was both with regard to the rural lifestyle precinct and the amenity zone.
So can I just clarify? So the original Chapter 24, which was the Wakatipu Amenity Zone and Lifestyle Precinct, that was notified in November 2017. So were you unaware of that?
No. In terms of that, what happened was that I received, and I'm not saying this is Council's fault, but for whatever reason, but it's one of these things that happens with email communication, I received no notification from Council of any changes, so it came like a big surprise to me when I was advised by Rosie Madison Lloyd that this had been reopened for the basin, and in fact it had been a goal and we kind of missed the boat at that stage.
Right.
So that came as a big surprise to me. So then I started making inquiries of other people like Mr. Tapper to see whether he'd become aware of it, because he should have got emails too. And it transpired that indeed in 2017, in November,
yes.
Mr. Tapper and others did receive from Council a memorandum.
Yes.
And it's the memorandum dated 23rd November 2017.
Yes, which I think I've got a copy of in the agenda. It's the same one. Yes,
23rd. And I clarify, I only became aware of this this year when it was put it out, but I did some back research, it wasn't something as well at the time. So the memorandum in paragraph 1 says that it's filed on behalf of the Council and its purpose is to provide information to the hearings panel as to what will be notified as part of stage 2,
yes.
And advise on what proposed district plan stage 1 provisions and submissions and further submissions on these provisions will be affected by the variation. Now, this comment is perhaps to give a clue as to why we were unaware, because if one reads the whole entire document, nowhere in there is there a clue anywhere that the submissions made by the Aircraft Owners and Pilots Association or any of the other 20 to 30 submitters who made submissions first time round, nowhere in there does it allude to the fact that those submissions will be affected by the variation.
Right.
And if one looks at the schedule which is attached as an Appendix B, and Appendix B, as I understand it, I stand to be corrected, but my Mr. Tapper read it agrees with me, it appears to try to identify all of the persons who made submissions on the rural zone of Stage 1,
yes.
Who will be affected by the change of variation,
yes.
and it attempts to set out who they are by party, and also to describe the submission summary and basically what it is that is affected. Now, nowhere in there, as I've said, is there any mention to former airports or any of the submitters that submitted on stage 1. So, Mr. Tapper and other members, having read this document, which was circulated, didn't pick up on any clue that it had any effect on us. And with respect, I have to wonder whether Council actually realised themselves that they had not alerted to conformal airports, because if they had it, why would they not do so? Because they tried, obviously, to get this, or the Council's Council tried to produce this to assist
to
Council with the planning process,
yes.
And it completely does not allude to it.
Right.
Now, similarly, I discovered when I was doing research this year, after the event, I looked at what was advertised for stage two, and it was a document produced similar to stage one.
Yes.
This document makes no mention of informal airports.
Yeah.
Stage one had a very comprehensive Section 32 report, which also intended to make people aware of what was involved, and it had a fact sheet which related to informal airports.
Yes, that's nice.
My back research, if you like, with stage two showed there was no Section 32 report for informal airports per se. The only mention they had was in the Waikato Basin informal airport Section 32 report, where one sentence says something like that the plan should take account of the prospect of a reverse sensitivity arguments over informal airports. That was it. Nothing else. Now, that likewise didn't alert any of our members to the fact that we need to submit again here, that they've changed the rules on this. We thought that our original submissions would still be valid. And I accept that that might be partly due to our naivety as laypeople, but we do strongly take the view that council, having changed the rules, having known that we submitted them in the first place, really had an obligation to make us aware of that, and they attempted to fulfil that obligation with that memorandum of 23rd November, where they attempted to locate all the parties who may be affected, but they completely omitted to realise that we were one of those parties.
Mm-hmm.
So what happened was we were caught by surprise, but our advice was that because the rules were linked with the standards, and the standards through fortuitously through an error in council notification, at least from the amenity zone had to be looked at, then okay, we should be able to get the standards that go with that, and also went with the rural zone and went with the lifestyle precinct, we should be able to get our argument heard on that. And I think that council, through their lawyers, their council, have always been very not keen on wanting to revisit this. But with respect, I think it may be useful to them if they did, because if one looks at the proposed district plan, and once again, I've looked at this in hindsight, not at the time, but if one looks at the proposed district plan for the Waikato Basin rural amenity zone,
yes,
it shows, and the rules, it shows informal airports as a permitted activity.
Yes.
And then, if you look at the standards, it shows it as discretionary activity. So we already have a conflict there.
Only discretionary if it's, if you
get
the 500 metre, if you're outside.
Correct. The standards are the thing. And the standards are the thing that we are concerned about, because it's the standards that contain the 500 metres.
Yes,
and we think that the standards close enough associated with the rules for both the precinct and the amenity zone, we should have been able to get our argument heard. So that probably then brings me to the actual process that happened in terms of the striking. And without wanting to go through that in its entirety and take up too much of your time, you will be aware that the strikeout rate proposal arose from a submission of Simpson Grierso, who was acting for council in the matter, and they basically made the submission, and a large part of that and the subsequent documents that flowed on from the chairman, particularly his interim decision and his final decision, they assumed that we had chosen, is the word that's been used, chosen not to make a submission to the district plan for the Waikato Basin, and that was basically our fault, and by choosing not to, we had missed the boat and we were out of luck. That was what it was saying. And what we're saying here, to use an air commissioner, is hang on a minute, how could we make submissions when we didn't know that we meant to make submissions? And of course, council's response to that was, well, you did know because you alluded to this document in your submissions, so you must have known. And I, of course, tried to make a point by sending an email through the secretariat to the chair. So I know I did allude to this, but I alluded to it because I found out about it way after the event. In fact, when I was doing research in August this year, I found out about it. And I alluded to it because it maybe provides a clue as to why we were never notified and why we were never picked up on the fact that we should be making submissions to the Basin, because we were simply not on the radar in this document. And therefore, we submit that the decision of the chair, which relied quite a lot on the fact that we should have made submissions, that he believed we were aware of, of what was proposed, was actually fundamentally wrong, because we weren't aware. We think the council should have given us the opportunity and told us that we needed to do that, not had it obscurely hidden, because the stage one process was very transparent. We had a very big Section 32 document. We had the proposed document. We had a fact sheet. Stage two, we had, although we weren't aware at the time, this document, which didn't allude to airports.
Yes.
We had a public notice in the papers, which didn't allude to informal airports. We had the document from Simpson Gresson, which didn't allude to informal airports. We had a Section 32 report with one sentence. Now, the association, in this context being myself, and our members being Mr. Tapper and the other 20-plus that made submissions on stage one, nobody picked up on the fact that our submissions were no longer valid for the Basin.
And
we required...
So nobody made submissions on
stage. No, the only people that made submissions on the Basin, because all of the Basin material was very weighted towards subdivision. If you read fact sheet for the Basin, such as it was, and you read the proposed, it's very subdivision weighted. So some people who... Obviously, you know, subdivision's a hot potato for some people. Some people that read that picked up on what was involved in informal airports, and they did make some submissions. I think there were about three or four parties who made submissions, whatever distances changed, in some cases greater, and in one case I think less, but they were mixed. But none of those parties, to the best of my knowledge, and I stress to the best of my knowledge because it's a little hard to figure it out sometimes, none of our submissions, to the best of my knowledge, made submissions the first time around when we thought that the rural area included the Wakatipu.
Oh, okay.
So I think those people that made submissions on the Basin, they got hooked in there to use that phrase because of the subdivision interest, which they were
interested in. And
they added the airport because they realised it was part of it when they read the thing in more detail.
Right.
We didn't read it in detail because we didn't think it involved us at the time. So that brings me to the, if you like, the fortuitous situation, as it was put to us by our solicitors, that we had another chance because council had
left the table out.
And then they said, well, we also think you have another chance because you can't really separate the standards from the rules. But council obviously don't agree with us, and the chair obviously didn't agree with us, and at the moment we've got this strange situation where we've made submissions on the rural zone, which now doesn't include the Basin, they're subject to mediation. We've made submissions on the rural lifestyle precinct. Mr. Tapper did that when I was overseas because it wasn't struck out, our submissions, as far as that part goes. We've got a good hearing.
Yes.
So we're now in a situation where council is and mediators will hear our argument and maybe we'll make some change, maybe they won't, but that's a process to be gone through. But no one's going to make any submissions because we missed our chance, if you like, according to council, on the standards as they relate to the rural lifestyle precinct. And that's a just from a common sense point of view, that's a huge gap in the system. Because from an aviation perspective, we don't see why you would have, just because of an administrative situation, why would you have different roles prospectively in different areas just because it was decided administratively that you should split them up? It doesn't make any sense. So from a practical point of view as well as a legal point of view, we think that council erred, and we would like the opportunity to be able to make submissions on the standards as they apply to the lifestyle precinct. Now, I've talked a lot about practical points of view, and I have done that to some extent deliberately, because one of the things I've done in the last 3 months is do a lot of reading about the RMA. And although it seems to have strayed into a bit of a, no disrespect to this commissioner, but into some sense into a playground for lawyers,
right.
It was never, from what I read, intended to be that way. It was intended to be a document that let the average Joe blogs have a say on various matters that affect our environment, and in terms of planning, a document that let the average Joe blogs have a say on what planning procedures should pop out the bottom of the process. And I think that it's quite wrong for us to not have a say simply because the rules were changed after we made our submission, that we're unaware that they changed along with the other 20 or so people that made submissions. Mm-hmm. And to end up with a situation which I describe in one of my submissions as being messy, and that's the best, mm-hmm. you know, that's the kindest thing you can say about it at the moment, very messy. And I mean, even if we look, as I say, at the current Lockerbie Basin proposed district plan, unlike the rural plan, which has been through the process and up to the appeal stage, it makes it clear that in the rules that the formal airports are permitted, but subject to the standards, yes. The proposed Lockerbie Basin plan simply says that they're permitted. It doesn't allude to the standards and the rules. You've got to then make your own call, but the standards must apply to the rules. And that in itself is, you know, is something that should be tidied up, but when you don't get a chance for anyone to make submissions, these things tend to slip through the cracks, because people will tend to look at the plan on the basis of what's submittable and not on by necessarily examining every bit of it to see if it makes sense. And look, I fully appreciate the enormity of the task that council has had. It is an enormous task. Now, to some extent, we feel a little guilty sitting here complaining about informal airports given the enormity of the rest of the plan, but they are an important aspect of it for our members and for aviation in general, and we feel very strongly that we're entitled to have our say on the matter, and that we've had that opportunity in regards to two-thirds, if you like, of the district,
yes.
But we've been denied it at the moment on the other bit. And I'm sure that someone could say, well, you know, you've always got the option of a judicial review or something else. But look, in reality, we're a membership association. We don't have the appetite to spend huge amounts of money on such things. We believe that council has an obligation to be responsible and pragmatic and to get a sensible result. And we don't think that they should be opposing us from having a say on it to the extent that they are. And that's really the short version of I hope it was short, of our argument.
Right. Oh, well, thank you very much. That's very helpful. Can I just go back to the difference between stage one, which is now being appealed and is going to mediation, so and the differences that then appeared in stage two for the Waikato Basin. So was the 500 metre rule, is it the same in both, the standard?
Yeah. Essentially in the proposed district plan and the...
Yes.
Yes. At the moment what's happened is the plan, which is stage one, which is up to the appeal stage,
yes.
In the standards it has the 500 metre separation.
Yes, because that was advertised as such in that fact
yeah.
sheet, wasn't it?
And that's essentially what our appeal revolves around,
right.
Because it's unachievable by and large.
Yes.
In the Waikatipu lifestyle, sorry, correction, in the Waikatipu rural amenity zone,
yes.
Although the wording has been made slightly simpler, it's basically the same. It's proposed in the standards that it be 500 metres.
Right.
And if that was unworkable in the rural zone, it's even more unworkable in what's now the rural amenity zone, because you simply,
yes.
by and large, can't find 500 metres.
500 metres,
so
yeah.
what we're, I mean, our argument will be that the council should, as other councils do, relies on the noise part of their plan by and large, or reduce their distance, one or the other, or both. But that's for another day. As far as the rural lifestyle precinct is concerned, at the moment it's proposed that informal airports be a discretionary activity, and it doesn't appear we're not sure, to be honest, how the standards relate to that, because there's no obvious connection in the plan between provisions for informal airports and the standards. It doesn't give you much clue as to how it goes. One imagines that they are linked,
right. But
doesn't actually say that. Mr. Tapper was heard at a hearing on the discretionary aspect and submitted that it should be brought into the same sort of criteria as the rural area and the
Rural amenity
area.
Right.
Commissioner, if I may, yes. Yesterday I was strange, that I should be hearing today. I was talking to a family of two members which had submitted originally on the stage one side of things,
yes. And
they were totally unaware of what's been going on. Totally. When I said to them, I want you to come back and see whether you did actually receive that documentation and that, one of them said they did look through it. Exactly the same as myself, there's no prompting for me.
Yes.
There was no mention of the word aircraft anywhere, and thought it was a planning matter that had gone out to just a lot of people, and totally disregarded. And the fact that all those people that in stage one and made certain submissions have not made any effort at all to put in a submission relating to this current matters would indicate to me, and to any, I think anybody, that there was a lack of knowledge across a wide spectrum of people, and to that extent, they would have, had they known, some of them would have submitted. I certainly would have.
High association would have. Yeah.
Right. So, Mr. Tapper, from your perspective, did you know about the stage two?
I got the same notification here,
yes.
and I looked at it, and I looked right through it, couldn't find anything to do with aircraft or association.
Yes.
So disregarded. In fact, I retrieved it from my deleted folder. Well, you know, got rid of it. But, you know, I still, one of the things I've had aircraft and helicopters based, actually in the base, in three different locations over the last 45 years with no problems at all, not one single complaint. And the big thing is that, you know, most of our people are very aware of the fact that the noise sensitivity is a big thing around Queenstown.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing is that we're not asking for a lot of movements or trying to make it into. Calling it an informal airport is against the paddock. You can land a plane on or a helicopter on occasion. This is the other thing, is that basically there was no negotiation made about the number of landings and takeoffs in a day or a week or a month or whatever the case may be. And this is why we're apart from the 500 metres, it's almost as though it's throw the dog a bone when they took out the section about from a 500 metres from a boundary, a road or a house. They took out two of them, but in effect, the one about the house was an impractical thing in the basin here.
So they took out boundary or road, but it's a house that stayed.
Well, now there were three factors in the original one,
and
two of them are gone, but there's still the 500 metres from the house or habitation.
The notional boundary of a residence, I think.
It says, from
any other zone, so there is a boundary.
Yes.
Or the notional boundary of any residential dwelling.
At my recent hearing, I said in my own case, you know, it's less than, with me personally, it's less than a movement a week, as far as I'm concerned.
Yes.
But I feel that most people would be more than happy with a movement a day maximum. Because most of the time we fly out, we go to where we're going to be doing all this, and we may come back the same day, but we may come back another day.
Right.
And generally, you're coming in, you land, it's not as though you're doing circuit training or doing any training and making continual noise. The amount of noise, especially on the approach, is very, very little. And on the takeoff, it might be for 30 seconds.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, we're getting into it.
Essentially, so nobody who... So just to clarify, I'm sorry, I'm probably repeating myself, but so 20 or 30 people made submissions on stage one in relation to the 500 metre proposed standard, but none of those submitters realised that they had to make essentially the same submission again.
Yeah, were aware that they had the opportunity to submit,
and
that would be the word.
Right.
Yeah.
Because when we made the original submissions, the rural zone was including the Wakatipa.
Yes. Mm. Yes, it did.
It may be naive, but we kind of thought, well, if there's any change that Sawyer Council would tell us.
Yes.
And that's obviously what they intended to do, because Otherwise, it wouldn't say that on the memorandum of 23rd November 17.
Yes. So did any of those submitters, or they did, you did get the memorandum, you just didn't appreciate that you had to...
I got the same information she used as you didn't...
I didn't get this at
you
the time.
No, you didn't get it.
I found it afterwards when I started researching what had gone on, because Anderson Lloyd said, you've changed it. And I said, what are you talking about? So I got online and I started researching it. And then I rang Mr. Tapper and said, did you get this? And he said, I don't know if I did. So then he called me back and said, I did.
So none of those submitters actually.
No.
So they didn't get.
Two of them yesterday, when I brought up the subject, they said, we weren't aware of that. And they're quite big landowners around here, and they've got quite an interest in them because they're involved in aviation as well.
Right.
Charlton Campbell from the CAA, he made a submission, but on his own private capacity, not CAA. He was unaware of it as well. I was talking to him about another matter 2 weeks ago, and I said, by the way, did you know? He said, no, I didn't know that. And these are reasonably, well, I don't want to sound arrogant here, but one would hope they're reasonably intelligent people that consider them intelligent enough to let loose with the aircraft. We don't think it was like that. It was so obvious that we were just dumb pilots. We should have, we somehow should have picked up on it, which is what council have been trying to suggest. Council could use that double one, is what they've been trying to suggest, that we. We knew this, and we chose not to make a submission. That's just completely incorrect. Why would we go to West Chapel if we chose not to make a submission?
Yes. So did you assume that your Stage 1 submissions that you had made and that the appeal would essentially cover these matters in this, or didn't you turn your mind to that?
Well, we knew when we made a Stage 1 submission that it included the Wakatipu Basin.
Yes.
Mm. And we thought, therefore, that we'd made submissions, we'll sit back and wait for the decision. When the decision came out, then we looked at it and thought, the 500 metres thing is still there.
Yes.
That's when we involved legal counsel, who said to us, well, are you aware that the basin is now a different category and that's been gone? And I said, well, no, it's news to me. When did that happen?
So even if you had looked at it, and seen this, you may have still thought you had been covered by your original submissions. Is that what you're saying?
Yes, very much so. Yes.
Yeah.
And I've looked at, there's one section in the Act which sort of suggests that if you made a submission and the policies have changed, that maybe the original submission still stands, but our legal advice is that it doesn't quite fit the bill, so it doesn't.
It doesn't.
We're kind of stuck there.
Yes. Yeah. So it's interesting, isn't it? So essentially this is almost as if the Stage 1, it is a carve-out, and it almost starts again, doesn't it? Is that how it sort of works from, just in layman's terms, from a planning perspective?
In this case, the variation, which is the Wakatipu Basin chapter in Wrightsdale Precinct,
yes, 24, yes.
Completely overwrites the rural chapter. It's a new it's a new zone and a whole new set of provisions, covering all manner of things in the rural area, glare, retail sales, roadside stores,
informal airports. But substantially the rules for informal airports are the same, with a bit of tweaking to the wording, and they've left out boundary or roads for the standards, but essentially the 500 metre is carried through, and there's no other substantive changes other than with the lifestyle precinct. It's now a discretionary activity rather than permitted. Is there something?
What I think we're trying to raise is that there was nothing in the documentation that was sent out that gave us any indication whatsoever that it was involving an informal airport in any way whatsoever.
Right.
And to that extent, the people who had submitted in Stage 1 were unaware that if they had a continued interest in anything on the basis, they should make a further submission.
Right.
Not even a word would indicate it.
Right.
I guess, you see, part of it, Commissioner, was that Stage 1, there was this document, which is quite thick, like section 32 of the Portland Airports now, stage two, there was one section 32 report for the entire base to cover everything.
Yes.
And Portland Airports, as I said, was one sentence which talked about reverse sensitivity. I've made comment that there we believe should have been a section 32 report, and we're not saying that just to be bloody minded, but what we're saying is that without a section 32 report, we had to submit more or less blind, and we still don't know what the rationale for what was intended for the amenity zone in the lifestyle precinct was, because it was never spelled out to us in the section 32 report. And in terms of the other thing is that because the section 32 report, particularly for stage one, was quite a big document, and also it was alluded to in the initial district plan notice, and also there was a specific informal airports fact sheet, you had to be pretty blind not to understand that, hey, something's going on here, and if you're interested, you should make a submission.
Yes, it was very good.
It was very well done.
Yes.
Stage two, I realised that council probably didn't approach the plan originally with the basis that their basin would be treated differently. I think, if I stand to be correct, I think that proposal arose from the commissioners, who asked council to have another look at it. That's what I've been told. And it may be that the resourcing and the time available wasn't there, because I understand that there's an enormous project. But the result of that was that it all just went completely under the radar for most people. And, you know, I think notification of any sort of legal process is quite an important part of it. And although council argued strongly via its solicitors that they did everything with requirement to notification, I think the facts actually speak otherwise with regard to informal airports. Not arguing with regard to subdivisions, because if you read the Basin reports, it's just about all talks about subdivisions. But in terms of informal airports, if you compare it to stage one, stage two was very, very light to the point of being pretty much non-existent.
Right.
And I don't think it's unreasonable that the fact is we did miss it, and if we hadn't been aware of it, we wouldn't be here today. We wouldn't have made submissions at the time.
Right. And so when the Section 32 report that you talked about for Stage 1, was that just on informal airports?
Just on informal airports.
Was that whole thing?
Whole topic, yeah.
Oh, I haven't had a look at that.
It's quite a document. It's quite a document.
Right.
You know,
and that wasn't referred to in
that document for Stage 1 got dealt with as one sentence in Stage 2, which seems kind of bizarre.
Right.
Yes.
Yes, I think that would be helpful. Yeah.
If I could just draw your attention to paragraph 19 of the Chair's strikeout decision.
Yes.
You will see that some parties did submit on the airport rules in the
So
I've just directed the Commissioner to paragraph 19 of the Chair's strikeout decision.
Yeah.
And what I would like her to notice is just that there were some parties who submitted on the airport rules in the notified chapter 24, and the submission numbers are there.
For stage two.
For stage two, yes. But I think Mr. Boyd's evidence was that those weren't people who submitted on stage one. These were different people. Is that right?
It's quite hard to look through the spreadsheets that summarise who submitted on what. From what I can make of it, and I stand to be corrected because it's quite hard to figure it out, but from what I can make of it, the people that submitted on stage two of the former airports, in other words the basin, were not the same people that submitted on the rural zone. I didn't pick up anybody who had realised that they needed to make another submission than they made one on, you know. I formed the view that people that had submitted it on stage two were probably principally interested in subdivision, but had put comments in there about the airports as well.
Because they picked essentially on reading. It's interesting because I suspect that the Waikato Basin one would have potentially had a lot more interest from, as you say, property owners within that precinct who may have actually then read the whole document and come across. Because, I mean, if you do read the document, it's very clear that I'm referring to, the chapter 24 variation. It does mention informal airports, and
yeah.
I haven't been back to have a look at the original stage one to see what the differences are, which is why I was asking you about the 500 metre. Was that the same standard? And I don't know whether the objectives and policies, in fact, Mr. Bayliss or Ms. Bailey might be able to tell me if there was what the differences were with four informal airports between the original stage one for the rural areas and the Wakatipu Basin, other than the variation around the lifestyle precinct, which we're aware of that rule being inserted, but otherwise it was a permitted activity subject to a standard, which was the 500 metre setback, for want of a better description. Which, as you say, did change in the decision, but were the other policies and the same? So we had policy.
I'm sorry. Are you asking whether the Chapter 21, Stage 1, the objectives and policies were different
for informal airports?
I would need to look at that and get back to
you. I can help you here a little bit. I think, Commissioner, the original proposals for informal airports for Stage 1 for the rural area, which at that stage included the basin, they were different to what's now proposed for the basin slightly, in the sense that the original proposals as drafted by council from memory had, I think, three landings and takeoffs per week, and the 500 metres was a separation not only required from adjoining residential platforms, but also from roads.
Right.
Now, in boundary of the property.
Yeah. And what happened during the hearing process, council revisited their proposals and conceded that having 500 metres from roads didn't make a lot of sense, so I dropped that. And they also, I think in an attempt to provide a greater level of concession, but it really didn't, they upped the number of landings from 3 per week to 2 per day. So that became essentially the decision that popped out from the commissioners. I don't think the commissioners, from memory, made any changes to what council agreed on at the hearing as it progressed.
Right.
The stage two, or as it is now, Wakatipu Basin Rural Lifestyle, Rural Amenity Zone.
Yes.
The standards in that are pretty much the same as the standards that popped out of the hearing at stage one. And it's those standards which are now subject to appeal.
Okay.
They're not the same as the standards that were originally in
the
document, but they're the same as the ones in the decision.
Okay.
Yeah. And the rural amenity zone is another... the rural lifestyle precinct is another can of worms, because what happened was that when the stage two concept was developed and basin came into that, the boundaries were adjusted and some land which had been rural came into the rural lifestyle precinct.
Precinct, yes, which is the dark grey on here.
Yeah, that's right. And in that it was discretionary, so the standards. Presumably, I don't know enough about to know whether the standards still relate to a discretionary activity or whether they don't. But anyway, it was deemed to be discretionary, which is different from the rural zone and the rural amenity zone.
Well, I mean, what the standards do, and Mr. Bayliss can correct me if I'm wrong, is that in this case, because it's a permitted activity in the amenity zone, if the standard's not complied with, it ends up being a discretionary activity.
Yeah.
So they essentially are a gatekeeper.
That would appear to be the common sense.
But there is no permitted activity standard in the lifestyle precinct.
It's all discretionary.
Rural lifestyle zone is notified and decided on in stage one, where it's a discretionary activity because of the smaller site sizes. So there's an expectation that people have to go through a resource consent to...
So was part of the outcome of the stage one decision in the rural residential and rural lifestyle and rural residential zones that it would be discretionary?
Yeah,
or informal lendings?
That's correct, yeah.
Right. So you presumably had appealed that?
The stage one didn't deal with rural lifestyle precinct, I don't know.
The rural lifestyle zone, sorry, the 70 zones.
Yeah.
The boundaries were changed when it became a precinct.
Yeah. There's no rural lifestyle zone in the Tipping Basin now.
No, so forgetting about the basin from it, if we look at the what's left in stage one, effectively, there's still the 500 metre rule, sort of standard, that's been
correct.
Appealed.
Yes,
but there's no, but other than that, it's aircraft, informal airports are permitted activity, is that correct?
Across they also have to meet the noise standards
and the noise standards.
And there's a limit on the number of flights per day.
That
went up.
Come up another four. I don't think, but for the small number of operations that recreation applies to, I don't think the noise limits as currently prescribed, something we're not happy with them, but as currently prescribed, the noise limits won't be an impediment, I don't believe.
Won't be an impediment, right.
Yeah.
But the 500 metres
can be. 500 metres will be, yeah.
In both zones. Although, yes, so we're not looking at the merits, we're just looking at really how to interpret the plan.
And wanted clarification. Council's evidence supported retaining the setback from roads, but the panel's decision did away with that.
Okay. So given... Sorry?
It's just one thing. I've often wondered why I can understand about the building. Why the road was a distraction of people driving?
It's probably not
a question for today, but...
The road's not mentioned in stage two anywhere, is it?
No,
it's just, it literally says the any other zone, so I assume that if it was on the boundary of a zone, or the notional boundary of any residential dwelling, so there's no mentions of roads or actually boundaries within the particular.
And the wording about another zone is a bit open. It's not great wording either, because another zone could be, there is, for example, a very small strip of rural zone land on the western side of Lake Hayes. So I imagine if one reads that literally, the 500 metres will apply if you're within 500 metres of that zone, which already carries the rural benefits. So I think it means another zone where the standards are tighter, not one where they're more liberal. But it doesn't actually say that.
There could be a lot of areas looking at this map that probably are going to be a bit tricky.
Yeah.
Be that as it may, that's what's being proposed. So my other question was, given the discretionary status, I'm now looking at the relationship between, and this is in the lifestyle precinct zone, so essentially that the, and I'm really now getting to what the substance of the relief that you're seeking.
Yeah.
So the commissioner has, so I'll go back a step before I get to my question, the hearing panel chair has essentially said that he is prepared to allow a submission on the noise limits prescribed in Chapter 36.
Yeah.
That they apply in place of Rule 28.4.28, which is...
Yeah, that was with regard to the precinct, was that
yeah,
right?
With regard to the precinct.
Yes.
So he was prepared to allow that. So if that... Is that relief something that you are seeking? It wasn't really clear that you were talking about the noise limits in your original submission.
Yeah, because with the precinct, we've had our day there, and Mr. Tapper attended.
Yes.
And indeed did make those submissions that it should simply be the noise limits that apply to the precinct. And I think, although I wasn't there, I understand you also said that if that wasn't acceptable, there was some discussion between you and the panel about what distance would be acceptable. Is that...
Yes, well, that was actually, and I was of the view, or I explained, there's very little should be between the two. It's either one standard, or it's going to it would apply to both the precinct and the rural area. And
So
the 500 metres.
So that would replace effectively the 500 metre rule. You would just basically go off the noise.
The noise standard applies anyway, doesn't it? If you had frequency and then you had objections and they did noise testing and found that it was outside those limits, that's fair and reasonable. Yes. If you're not complying, that's fine. But we've actually agreed quite a lot with Charles, Dr. Charles, in this noise calculations. And in actual fact, it shows that the amount of noise that would probably occur, or almost certainly occur, with our type of operations would be well within what's considered to be acceptable after about two to three landings and clearings a day.
We have a lot of respect for Dr. Charles. He's acted for members who have applied for resource consents as well as for council. Yes. And his evidence was pretty clear. We didn't take any great exceptions to it.
Yes.
His evidence to the council was that, with two landings per day, it's at such a low end of a scale that the standard probably doesn't even apply. There's a New Zealand standard for helicopter pads and sort of airstrikes. And if you wanted to take a very conservative approach, you could go with 500 metres. So that was what council did. But if you look at the information he presented, that Dr. Charles presented, wouldn't be breached down to as little as, depending on which direction you went from the landing place, as little as 80 metres and 150 metres in other directions. So there was a lot of scope to bring that down. That will be part of our argument for another day, largely in the mediation. But if you're looking at what relief are we looking for after this process in terms of people being here today, what we're looking for is, what we'd like to see is to be able to mention that the chair was wrong and perhaps misinterpreted our earlier submission and that he thought that we had been aware of the notifications back in November last year, and we weren't, that he thought that we had chosen not to make submissions then, when in fact we didn't choose, we simply were ignorant of the need to. And we would like to think that we could convince you to find that it is open to us even under the revised notification that council gave for the precinct, that because it's pretty hard to separate the standards from the rules, that it's open for us to make submissions on the 500 metres and have them accepted because they form part of the standards, not the rules. And I think there's a bit of case law which I was pointed to, if you like, by Anderson Lloyd in our submissions on that point.
Yes.
But because if we don't get that, we're in a situation, from a practical point of view, where we've made submissions on the rural area, which has now been trimmed back. We've made submissions on the lifestyle precinct, but we're not able to make any submissions on the amenity zone, which therefore would default to probably what's proposed in the plan at the moment, which would mean a rather sort of a weird situation to have a plan which one would think in terms of a topic like informal airports could be relatively informal, relatively consistent, I should say, across the district.
Oh, so when you say you've made submissions on the lifestyle precinct,
that was
your submission?
Yes, we weren't allowed to make anything in the rural zone. And in actual fact, the rural zone is actually more important to us and from a practical
You mean the amenity zone? Sorry, I'm
going. No, the amenity. The amenity.
I'm still thinking rural is stage one, except for this carve out, and then
that's
within
right.
the carve out, we've got amenity and precinct.
Yes. Well, the area, for example, where an airstrip per se would probably be going would be in that area. You see, we weren't able to make any.
For example, we know of some active airstrips that our members have, which are in that area, which is rural amenity.
Yes.
And they made submissions, the owners of those properties made submissions back in 2015 or whatever it was, thinking that you know, that was all part of the rural zone which it was, and that would cover them. And then they were completely unawares as well that hey, now you're in a different zone and you shouldn't make submissions on it.
Right, right.
So if they can't get relief, they're going to be in a position of having to argue, maybe successfully, maybe not, about existing rights use and stuff like that, which is never easy because, you know, scale and intensity, all that stuff's got to be similar, and it gets very hard to prove. You know, if we think back to what council's objective was in the Section 32 report, which
the one I've got, yes,
I mean, they make it clear, good on them, that look, yes, they wanted to avoid this situation of anybody who wanted to be able to land an aircraft occasionally at their property or a friend's property, and they wanted to avoid the necessity of having to go racing off with wife and resource consent, because, you know, that process is time consuming, expensive, stressful, and if it's a nice afternoon, you think, I wouldn't mind going and landing at Jules Place, you're not going to go and ring up at 1 o'clock and say, what a resource consent to go and do that at 2 o'clock. So, you know, this council recognised that and said, well, let's put some common sense stuff in here that will work with this. The problem was they just overcooked it a little bit, perhaps through lack of knowledge, perhaps, in terms of two things. One was the 500 metres, and the other thing was, you know, in terms of allowing sort of in those more rural areas only 2 landings a day, because, and this is just by way of background, we'll address this in our mediation, but the association has what we call fly-ins, where members may get 20 aircraft and it's advertised, and they'll fly to a place like the Branch of Station Airstrip or Dingleburn Station Airstrip or the Hunter Valley Station Airstrip or the Reese Valley or somewhere like that. Now, 20 aircraft will do that, but at the moment that's now not going to be allowed either, so, you know, because only 2 landings and takeoffs per day, so that's going to be a breach.
Yes.
So we want to talk about that as well, but it doesn't affect the discussion today, but those are the sort of issues that,
yes,
that we want
so
to talk about.
So that's going to be through the mediation process. No, I mean, because the original fact sheet that came out on informal evidence made it quite clear that that was proposed a minimum distance to be 500 metres.
Yeah.
But I can definitely see why it's confusing when, you know, this carve-out happens, but it's essentially the same rules as you've already submitted on, but you're essentially, because of the way the process works, you are supposed to then resubmit on the actual provisions.
Yeah.
So your main issue is as actually linking the standards or being able to submit on that same standard.
Yeah. Our main issue for the, you know, we don't want to, I mean, we're recreational flyers, we have, it's our kind of our hobby and our recreation, we don't want to upset our neighbours and all that kind of stuff.
Yes.
We you know, try to live in harmony with people. We realise the density of the basin has increased, and that's sort of helped by stealth up to a point. But we just want somehow to come to an arrangement with council whereby we can continue to enjoy our recreation in a manner that doesn't annoy other people, and we'd like to have our say on how that can be achieved. At the moment, we don't have any mechanism to do that because we thought we'd done it, it got moved into another regime, we didn't know about that, and here we are, equipped with the other paddle, if you like, apart from today, because we don't have any way of having our say.
So, no, I understand that. Mr. Tapper, when you submitted in on the lifestyle precinct, did you talk about the standard as part of that?
The 500 metres?
Yes.
Yes, very much so.
And so the commission was prepared
in conflict basically with common sense and what Charles himself in his own report said.
Yes.
I can't for the life of me understand where the 500 metres came from. It's almost as though it was put in there, knowing that within the basin it would be very, very hard for anybody to get in compliance. It certainly has never been in previous stuff before. And what's actually happened, we've had the creep from all the subdivision and building out on the countryside, which is impinging on our activity to the extent that by putting in 500 metres in, you've closed the door.
Yes. So just process-wise, and I'm just trying to understand why you were allowed to be heard by the panel, but the...
Oh, no, I was speaking on behalf of AABA.
Oh, I see.
I was overseas.
He was in China.
I see.
And the hearing was set down, and I thought, how am I going to do this? I'm in China.
Okay.
And I contacted the council and said, look, is there any chance of changing the dates? No, there was no chance of changing the date. So I thought, what are we doing now? And a suggestion was made, well, can you not get someone else as a member to appear for you? So that's why the whole was set up.
So you have been through this process. I didn't actually appreciate that. The decision was made that you would be heard on the precinct only. So
that's
that
right.
Yes.
And we were.
Not Mr. Tavern. Mr. Tavern himself as an individual didn't actually make a submission, would have been in a similar vein to what we were making Mr. Yes. Tavern. So it's much better to simplify the process.
Absolutely.
Yes.
So you have submitted on the two areas that the panel said that you could.
Yes.
Effectively.
Yes.
Just correct me if I'm wrong, so you've actually argued that the noise limits should prevail and in place of the rule, and that the rule, did you also argue that the rule should be deleted for...
No, I don't think we did, actually.
For the precinct?
We didn't submit to delete the rule.
No, we didn't.
Okay.
It was a very instance where...
I guess by implication I could say we did, because you submitted to that it should be, instead of being discretionary, that it should be
permitted.
Yeah. So I guess whether that's technically doing anything of substituting, I don't know, but whether it's just changing, but that's what we did.
Effectively you have... argue that it should be reverted back to a permitted status, should be changed.
Obviously permitted, but subject either to comply with the noise, which was our first choice, and I think the noise, if there was further relief from noise, there was discussion about...
We didn't actually, at that stage, offer a reduced from 500 metres, but that is the view that we have too, that it could be reduced and still be well within the compliance stage.
Because what we actually did, we looked at the district plans of all of the South Island local authorities to see what they said about what's called here informal airports and what other people call different things and different plans.
Yes.
They ranged from being completely incomprehensible through to not addressing it at all, but the most common way of dealing with them was to say basically that as long as you comply with the noise standards, then you can do it. That was end of story. There were variations on that, but that was the overwhelming way that most authorities dealt with it. And that seemed to be common sense, because if you think about what is it that your neighbours or anybody else are not going to like about it, it's probably noise. So if you comply with the noise, then, most people say that you don't.
And frequency of noise.
And frequency, so it would still be the two movements per day.
We were thinking around about two movements a day, and coming back down to 150 metres, somewhere around about that, and that would be well inside what Charles and the council's own noise experts have actually said would happen.
Okay.
And the noise with a lot of these light aircraft is quite low. There's only one or two airplanes around that might be a bit harky for a few seconds.
Because I think what council recognised is that if you look at the history of resource and city applications for informal airports, there's been a few.
Yes.
In most cases, they've been granted because it's been decided that the noise levels and any other effects would be less than minor. And in one case, I'm thinking of the distance from another house and the owner objected was only 80 metres. But nevertheless, because there were some trees and other physical features in between, the noise experts' evidence was that the noise level would be below what one would normally expect to be reasonable for the area, and they were granted. And I think, some have had conditions attached, but I'm not saying there never has been, but I don't know of any application that's been made that hasn't been granted, and the distances are usually being less than 500 metres, and the council will sort of say, well, hey, we want to avoid the process for this ring roll, and so why would you say 500 metres? Because it's not going to cut the mustard in terms of reducing the need for
protection. The McElroy decision, a chapter that a lot of chapter there, was 80 metres.
So essentially then, so you've submitted on the precinct, so the relief you're seeking today is to be able to submit on the balance of just the grey area.
Yep, the grey area.
And would you make essentially the same submission
essentially,
that you've made for the precinct?
I think we alluded to it.
Yes.
When I made it. You may not have been able to directly address it, but I think it was alluded to at the time.
Right. So as far, can I then ask, as far as the these objectives and policies in table 24.1, and if I look at the, I'll go back a bit, sorry, I'm in the wrong place here.
24.22.
Yeah, 24.226. You're not interested in submitting on that. That's the objective that states.
Is that the noise part, you mean?
No, this one just says the objective is that non-residential activities are compatible with infrastructure. So this is these are in the objectives and policies section of the chapter
24.226, yeah.
Yes.
So
is that...
No, there's nothing that jumps out as there as being unreasonable.
Right.
As I said, we're not out to upset people and make life hell for neighbours and all that sort of stuff.
Yes.
At all. And we're looking for a compromise that enables us to enjoy doing what we've been doing.
Yes.
And that doesn't upset neighbours. And we recognise that aircraft are a very emotional topic, and I'm sure council knows that. You don't have to talk about airports or aircraft, and everybody's got a view on them, and it's a highly emotive topic, and there's a lot of misconceptions out there, and you kind of have to get through that. And nobody wants to have helicopters near them, except when they want one, they want it straight away. Or if they want to be in one, they want it there too.
Yes.
Or if they want to get rescued by one, but that, they don't know about them, And somewhere in amongst all that jumble of emotions, there's an answer.
Yes, no, I understand that. But as far as that particular objective and policy, you're comfortable with that?
I'm comfortable with that.
Yes. And 24, then just further down, in fact, the next one, 24.2.3.1, ensure informal efforts are not compromised by the establishment of incompatible activities.
That's the next one now.
So that's the next one down.
24.23, that's the reverse sensitivity.
So that obviously you'd be comfortable with it's designed to protect.
Yeah, because that's largely what's given rise, we're comfortable with that, but it's largely what's given rise to the current position. It's been, there's been a lot of subdivision by stealth, if you like, in the basin.
Yes.
And, so that what was a relatively rural environment is now not such a rural environment, and those people are starting to complain. And same thing's happened at Arthur's Point. It's very close to the rural zone out there. People within but there's increasing subdivision as well, and reverse sensitivity is certainly a factor.
Yes,
and we see it in other spheres as well, don't we? With the rural people complaining about the roosters and the neighbour's property, or dogs barking or tractors making noise or something else. It's just part and parcel of life.
Yes, yes, no, absolutely. And it applies to a whole lot of activities, actually, that one. So really then, if I'm narrowing this down, so the really you want the opportunity to be able to submit on standard 24.5.14, which is the setback.
Yeah, that's 13 standard, 24.5.14, that's right.
Yes.
That's the number of it.
In relation to the amenity zone.
Correct.
That's exactly what we want.
Exactly right.
And you've already submitted on that in relation to the lifestyle precinct.
Correct.
Is that correct?
Yeah.
Correct.
Sorry.
You've already done it with the precinct, and we've done it with the rural area, and appealed that decision because we've still got 500 metres there.
Okay.
So obviously what we're hoping to do, if we get a chance to have a say, is to try to get 500 metres, modified, better still dispensed with or whatever, but that's a discussion for another day. But because if you put it in there, it's not.
Yes, and I can see the point that if there's one rule for one standard for the rural areas, yeah. and then another standard for the lifestyle precinct, and another standard for the amenity areas, it is going to get
messy. Is a good word, isn't it?
It is a good word. I wouldn't want to be a pilot over that. You'd have to get your map out. Because it's actually when you actually look on the ground, there's no delineation between
the
zones
right.
at all.
No, it's a line on the map. Yeah,
it is a line on the map. And all right. Oh, that's very helpful. So if I could now ask Ms. Bailey and Mr. Bayliss, in terms of the process with the hearing, where are we with that? And if I did grant permission for the association to put in a submission on this one particular point, which is what's being asked for, what impact would that have on the process and the other points that were raised with relation to other submitters being given the opportunity to be given a fair hearing?
I would have to notify the submission post media and then
yes.
allow people to make further submissions. And then there would be, if people wanted to be heard, there'd be we'd have to arrange a hearing. Potentially, council can choose not to have a hearing if no one wanted to be heard. Council would have to prepare evidence.
Yes.
We probably wouldn't do the same sort of evidence exchange as we did, but we have to be in, you know, we have to meet those statutory requirements for doing council's section 42A report, etc., before the hearing. We were expecting to get decisions on the Waitakere Basin chapter and precinct to the middle of December. Allow us to notify in January, but that would obviously have to all push out.
Right, and so the precinct argument has already been made, but it wasn't. I suppose it's a bit hard without actually sitting through the hearing to know whether the commissioners the panel would then take that into consideration for the rest of the basin completely or not, or is it
the panel might decide that they've already sort of heard your issues.
Yes, that's what I was thinking.
Consider your submission on that, on the rest of the provisions in the basin without having to hear you.
If the panel would, I guess that's an interesting point actually. Would you make exactly the same submission for the whole basin as that you made for the lifestyle precinct? Is there anything different about your submission?
We might tweak it a wee bit, but I doubt very much if there'll be much difference in the world.
No, from memory, there wouldn't be a substantial amount of difference. There may be some in some points.
Right.
I mean, just in terms of relief, talking practically, one of the other suggestions that's been made by our legal advisors is that if the mediation is scheduled for March next year,
yes.
they did raise the possibility that if a decision has been made on the on the zone, on the lifestyle, if a decision's been made, on the rural amenity zone by the time the mediation comes around,
yes.
it may be that the mediators might feel inclined to let us wrap the whole of the basin, which is the precinct and the zone, and the rural zone, into the mediation process because it would make sense. And we did make, it's the lawyer on behalf, did make submissions to council that might be a sensible solution, but by way of response, it was rejected. And and they wanted us to go through two separate procedures, which, you know, it was a cost and hassle as well, because from our point of view, it's a district-wide issue, it's not separated the right way, but nevertheless, we did make in our last email communication with Ian, we did mention that, look, we're not out here to be bloody minded. If council can come up with some solution that enables us to have a say somehow, we're open to receiving any ideas. We're not here to try and score points for the sake of it. We just want to get a practical result in terms of having our point of view considered for the entire basin, not just for parts of it.
Commissioner, could I make a procedural comment?
Yes.
So, as I interpret the sections, the outcome of having an objection upheld is that the struck out submission becomes live.
Yeah,
it doesn't mean that there's an opportunity to resubmit, or an amended submission.
That's right. So the original submission would just the whole of it, because at the moment it was only part that was struck out. So that would then become live.
Yeah,
which is the original submission here. Yeah. I guess practically though, when you appear in front of the panel and you then make your case, you sort of embellish on what's often that's said in the submission around the points that have been made. But I did note actually that there was no, in your original submission, you hadn't actually commented on those two specific objectives and policies that we discussed earlier that you're comfortable with. So that wasn't actually raised in here.
Because we were comfortable with
them. You were comfortable with them. So it's really just the 500 metre standard the issue, isn't there? But the way it reads, it did talk about objectives and policies, but then it does get, I think we talk about the standards. It left it open, I suppose, but there was no specific reference to it. But what you're saying is that there is, you are comfortable with those. Because those, of course, would be relevant if you did have to apply for a discretionary consent. The decision maker would take into account the objectives and policies in the plan, but there's only really those two that mention, and the rest of them would be taken into account as well to the extent that they're relevant, but they are more around management of effects.
Yeah.
So,
yeah, that's a messy one. I mean, there's no obvious.
No.
Sort of.
So, if practically speaking, then. Is there, if the relief was to be granted with relation to the amenity zone, which is what we really narrowed this down to, is there a practical way of having that included? Would the association want to be heard by the panel, for example, or would you be comfortable for your evidence that you've already given to the panel to just be applied to both zones? And would that make a difference? I'm trying to think through.
I do know there are other parties who are really concerned about the operation of aircraft activity in the basin, and want to be able to further submit on any submission we want to.
So have there been, there's been, according to that, I think there've been two submissions in opposition, is that right? Two submissions opposing the rule and one supporting it. And then there were two parties lodged submissions on rule 25.4.14, which is the standard in question. What do you know what the content of those was?
We can provide them to you if that would help.
Actually, that's helpful. That would be helpful, actually. Because it doesn't say whether they've supported or opposed the standard. In fact, probably all five of those submissions, copies of all five of those submissions would be helpful. Because the first one was really on the discretionary, on the table where the activity is being now classed as discretionary in the lifestyle precinct, so you've already been heard on that. So that's really not a live issue anymore, is it? It's really just the amenity zone. Whether it should be extended to that amenity zone.
And well, it's still a live issue in that, you know, they have obvious standing to, they don't like the, any decision.
On appeal.
At the moment they don't have standing to appeal.
Correct. That's right.
Well, unless somebody else appeals, they probably could make a good case if they've got an interest greater than the public generally.
Yes.
The problem we've sort of got with the relationship between the precinct and the zone is that if you look at it from the point of view of the panel, the hearing panel, they've heard our submissions on the rural zone and then they heard our submissions on the lifestyle
precinct. Yes.
It must be hard if you're in that position not to be thinking to yourself, well, hey, you know, it won't make any sense for us to give any leeway, if you like, on the lifestyle precinct, because then that would be more liberal than the amenity zone.
Yes.
So it's kind of like we feel like we are a bit prejudiced as well in regard to our submissions, which we have made with regard to the precinct, because any reasonable person must be thinking what I've just sort of outlined, because it would be a nonsense to think, well, we heard what Mr. Stapper said with the rural amenity zone and we think he's right and we're going to change the rules there, but we're still going to leave them as they are for the precinct. But you end up with a bit of that would defy common sense to some extent.
Mm-hmm. Yes, no, I can see it's going to get quite free. Potentially get quite pregnant, because as you say, the precinct is a more sensitive zone
than
the amenity zone,
yeah,
where you've got
that.
The 80
we get that.
Yes.
Yeah.
So I mean, the fact that you've been heard on the precinct zone is probably quite advantageous. But I guess I'm surprised in a way that you got heard on the standard, because I think the decision of the panel chair basically doesn't really. It just says the noise limits, and then it says the noise limits apply in place of Rule 25.4, or that the rule be deleted.
Yeah.
It doesn't give you, jurisdiction to submit on the standard. But it seems that you were viewed on the standard, and you're comfortable with that. So there's.
And then we get back to the earlier discussion that the chair obviously.
It's called a bugger's money.
The chair obviously put quite a lot of stock in the fact that we've chosen not to make a submission, and we hope we've convinced you that we didn't choose it just on that hand.
Yes, that's right, and as Mr. Bailiff said, it is a carve out from start from square one again.
Yes.
And then you have to go through the process. And these have been tweaked a little bit as a result of the previous process, which is what you would expect as well. So as far as the process is concerned, it is completely legitimate process. It's just that it's quite hard, if you're, as you say, a lay person, to understand that, well, actually now we have to turn around and make the same submissions again with respect to the...
Presumably you'll go back to that memorandum of the November 17th. Presumably the parties who were identified in the back of the ordinary schedules would have seen your name here and thought, hey, it's something affecting us here, we mentioned.
Yes.
So, one would have expected that they might have picked up on the fact that they needed to do something, because if you read paragraph one, it saw your name on the back, you'd think.
Yes.
And I didn't see that at the time, but Mr. Tapper did and other people did, and because we weren't mentioned, that didn't really bounce.
It didn't mention informal airports. Whereas anyone who had property in that area would have read that the Waikato Basin was going to be rezoned into another. And it was actually quite common knowledge.
Yeah.
I mean, there'd been newspaper reports and that kind of thing. I think people were waiting for it to come out. So, and I think council has actually been very good at notifying people about the process on the way through, because I get all the notifications, so I was sort of following what was happening quite, but without going into the detail. So, Ms. Bailey.
If I could just add a point of clarification about that memorandum. You'll see my name is on the front of it, so I was involved in drafting that. The purpose of it wasn't to describe every rule in every chapter that was being notified, that's why paragraph 6 says that it's important to make a separate submission.
Yes.
And in terms of the appendices at the back, those are directed to showing which submissions are deemed to be carried across into the variation. So it's not an attempt to identify every person who is affected.
So all of these people who are identified in these appendices would have to make a new submission.
No, because their submissions to stage one on the zoning, seeking rezonings and the walk to the basement, are deemed to be
carried over
on the variation.
Oh, so who makes that decision then?
It's not a decision. It's just the RMA says that if you do a variation that essentially overrides it, what you propose, then the submission on the originally proposed provisions are deemed to be on the variation.
Right. So why was the submission of the airline AOPA not carried over then?
The rules didn't change from the decisions in the... Obviously, it becomes less clear. It's very clear that people who have submitted requesting specific zones in the basin...
Yes.
...that their submissions have... deemed to be on the variation, but it's less clear that people have submitted on rules within the rural chapter that would have applied within the basin. Should be deemed to be on the variation. That's the thinking, was it? They wouldn't.
About the rural area generally.
Yeah.
So.
As well as.
Because, I mean, it does seem strange that if someone had, given that it hasn't materially changed, that if you did make a submission on stage one, that wasn't then carried over. Or that you had to essentially resubmit the same argument.
If you wanted the same argument to apply.
Given that the submission had been made on stage one and it was, and yet these provisions and in fact had gone to appeal and had been appealed at that stage, or maybe not. When did the decision come out on stage one? Was that after the?
I believe it was May this year.
May this year. So that decision came out after this was stage two was notified.
Because the memorandum in that first paragraph, which is probably easier, it does say that. Its purpose, being the memorandum, is to provide information and advise on what stage one provisions and submissions will be affected by the variation. Mm-hmm. So surely if you made a submission on stage one, mm-hmm. and then that was no longer relevant to part of what you thought it was relevant to, surely that would have to be the submission that was affected by the variation.
Mm. Yes,
then it went on to actually identify the parties that were in that voters that were listed.
Mm.
So surely that, I mean, I admit it, I didn't get it at the time, I read it later, but when I read it I thought, well, this came out in the plain English meaning, it appears to me to be, to tell people that if you made a submission on stage one or further submission, and it's been affected by the variation to stage two, then...
It's taken on.
Yeah. That's what it says.
Yeah, that's right. And, I mean, it's an interesting point because, for example, say the, for argument's sake, the G Chapter 24 had been notified with a 1,000 metre setback, just picking numbers here, or just something that was materially different, would that have then give rise to a notification, a specific notification, or for informal airports? I mean, it seems to me that it's a fact that it's really essentially stayed the same, but somehow it's just managed to get missed out of the loop.
The broader issue for council is that when it notifies a set of plan provisions, it should make an effort to let people know that if they're making a significant change in an approach, and that's what we did when we notified the proposed plan in 2015, because it was substantially different to the operative plan, where a permitted activity for informal airports is just really for farming purposes and community services and things.
Yes.
And there was that deliberate change, and that was sort of publicised and was addressed in Section 32, as pointed out.
Yes.
Whereas, there are a large number of rules and standards and policies which were different in the Waipatipu Basin as a result of Chapter 24, and we didn't sort of make a monumental effort to identify each specific change for practicality reasons. The essential approach was the same as what council notified with the proposed plan in 2015. So
I think it didn't
highlight it in the same way that it did with the changes to subdivision.
No, but then I think the point I had missed, actually, which very helpfully made, is that a lot of the submissions were actually deemed to be carried over. So it probably didn't matter if people missed it. If you're going to carry them over, then I can see that you don't really have to make too much effort as the council, because people are still in the process. And then they obviously still have to read it and decide whether they want to be heard. But if they're not deemed to be carried over, then they do, as in the AOPA, they are then required to make a new submission, and that's where we seem to be getting into a technicality in a way. Were there many, do you know if there were many submissions that weren't carried over? Because there's a huge number that appear to be.
Have been a great many that were not carried over that remain in stage one.
Are in this area kind of thing, or have interests in this area, as opposed to just stage one? Because I mean, obviously, this will mainly affect landowners or people who have interests like the AOPA in the Waipatipu Basin area. So you wouldn't expect everyone in stage one to be carried through, because they might be submitting on Wānaka or Hawea or something like that. I guess it was in terms of the Waipatipu Basin.
Is your question how many stage one submissions are live in the Waipatipu Basin?
Yes, how many were deemed to stay live for this?
I don't know in terms of numbers, but if there is any stage one land, it's not coloured blue, then any submissions on that will stay live.
Okay.
So, I mean, our approach was the sort of all the submissions on mapping notations in the Waipatipu Basin, whether that be ONLs, ONFs, or zones.
So they were all deemed to be carried over.
Sorry, not designations. They were all deemed to be carried over.
Right, but anything else wasn't effectively.
No.
Yeah. Is that made clear in the memorandum? Submissions and further submissions. Generally, these are grouped together.
I would suggest you start at paragraph 6 of the memorandum.
Yes.
So the intention was that if people were interested in any of those separate stage 2 topics,
yes,
they needed to make a separate submission. decision on that, so to look at that chapter which was provided and to make a submission. And I wrote the memo, and I did. Perhaps that makes me a bit, I have maybe a different interpretation of it, but I think overall the thrust of the memo is this is a new regime for the Wakatipu Basin.
Yes.
And if you are interested in the Wakatipu Basin,
yeah,
so a separate submission might be needed, and so it's important to look at the chapter.
Yeah, but I guess I'm just trying to, so in the memorandum, say for example I had made a submission, I'm a landowner in this area, and I had made a submission on stage one. Is there something in here that tells me that my submission is going to be carried over? So I'd made a mapping, a change to it, so I wanted my land rezoned to rural residential for argument's sake, in the original submission. Would I be told that my submission was carried over automatically, but then I still obviously could make a further submission?
If your name is in one of the appendices.
In the appendices, so you would, yes, so you would have to look through. Okay.
But, I mean, a memorandum is not an official document, is it? It's the public notice, isn't it?
The purpose of the memorandum, big picture, is to describe what's being notified, but that doesn't change the adequacy of what actually was notified.
That's right. Yeah. That's our point.
Yeah.
Because with respect, in stage one, it was very clear that informal airports were being notified.
Yes.
But in stage two, it was far from clear. There was no mention of them in either the fact sheet. The Section 32 report contained, we discovered later, one sentence. And so everybody, including the association, Mr. Tapper, apparently everybody that submitted on stage one, completely missed seeing anywhere in the stage two notifications that was a live topic that we should make submissions on. I mean, if we had realised that, we would have done so, and we wouldn't be here today. And the other people that we've alluded to, likewise, would have made submissions. With respect to one reason, it gives the fact sheet just talked about subdivisions. That was the whole thrust of what was alluded to be about.
Yes, all right. Well, I think, is there anything else anyone would like to say by way of clarification? I think I understand the position of the arguments. From council's perspective, any other? I think we've talked about the process going forward. Is there any other points that you'd like to raise?
Commissioner, it may be that when I have a look at the Section 32, there may be some clarification in there that the Council has adopted its previous Section 32 material for purposes of this variation, where it's not looking to change the approach, but I don't know off the top of my head if that's a sentence, wasn't
it? Yeah, I actually did have a read. Well, I had a read it because I've got that Section 32 report that's in the agenda, and I went through it trying to find something on informal airports, but actually I couldn't. But I haven't gone through with a very fine tooth comb. But I had a read through it. There's actually, apart from the reverse sensitivity, there's one, I think, comment on that, on the policy, around reverse sensitivity. But that was the only thing I could find as well. Here we go. It talks about the Wakatipu Basin zones, but the amenity zone and the lifestyle precinct, but it doesn't specifically talk about informal airports anywhere. But yeah, if you can find something like that, would be helpful. But it was really only in the. Even in the policy, section 2.11 and then 2.2.2, which talks about the objective within the policy framework. It doesn't, it still doesn't mention informal inputs, I don't think. And that despite the fact that there is actually a policy on that in the actual chapter 24 variation. But it certainly talks about compatible land use and enhancing landscape character and amenity values, which is really the thrust of that objective.
One final comment that I'd like to make. Just thinking about the jurisdiction that we're in,
yes.
I would just like the Commissioner to bear in mind that in the Section 357 framework in that jurisdiction,
yes.
The question isn't whether the notification was adequate, the question isn't whether the person read the notified chapter or not. The key question is, was the struck out because it was not on the variation?
Yes, exactly.
And I would just ask the Commissioner to bear that in mind.
That's why I've been asking the questions about the process, because, to answer that question, you do have to look at it holistically.
Yes.
Yeah, you can't, yeah. Because I think the issue is as the AOPA has raised, is that it was the variation, it was the missing out of the table. If it hadn't been for that and the notification around the missing table, this wouldn't have come to anybody's attention. Potentially, it would have gone through, and so then we wouldn't be sitting here today. So, but whether part of the question is whether that, because that table was then notified separately, wasn't it? It went through its own process. So whether that is the narrow view of what is on the variation, or whether you have to then adopt the wider view, because you could say, well, that table can't really sit in isolation from the chapter.
That's the point where you would need to apply the case law principles and ask whether that variation changed what was in the chapter. And for informal inputs in the amenity zone, the variation didn't change that.
No, what it did was tightened up on the nature of the consent or the activity status for informal airports in the rural, in the lifestyle, in the precinct. Yes. Yeah.
Just on that, Commissioner, I take the point that's been made, but it is essentially we're dealing with an objection under Section 41. Related to interpretation of Section 41.
Yes.
And basically, the way I read Section 41, to strike out a submission, there has to be a finding that the submission shows no reasonable cause or case.
Yes.
Now that's, there's been some case law on that, but it's quite a wide definition, and I think that, to say that we have no reasonable causal case, given the history that we've outlined today and the discussion we've had, I think is incorrect. That's really the crux of it. I mean, the Chairman found that we had no reasonable causal case to make submissions about the interpretation of the standards.
Yes.
And we're saying, well, excuse me, but we think we did, because they're really inseparable from the rules.
Yes. Yes, but then the panel did hear your submissions on the stand, yep. didn't they? And they didn't rule them out at that stage. They didn't suggest that you shouldn't have been making submissions.
Sorry, what was that one? That
they didn't. When you were at the hearing, did they try and limit what you were submitting on, or were they?
Oh, you mean the hearing yes. for the lifestyle precinct? Yes. Did you voluntarily limit it, George, or what happened there?
No, I tried to go outside of just talking about the precinct, but I was eluding all the time as much as I could until I was stopped, and nobody stopped me, so that's the old story.
Oh, okay.
Didn't ask for forgiveness and permission.
But you don't know what weight they gave to it. They may have said, well,
they may well come back and say, yeah. well, we can't give it any weight because we had struck it out.
Yeah,
you could rely on that till we get the decision.
God loves a trial.
Well, the problem, having sat on hearings, Ben, the problem is you get really interested in when you're in that. This is a process hearing, as we all understand, but when you're in that substantive hearing, you get really interested.
Yeah.
So they tend to go all over the place. Yeah. Because ultimately what you're trying to do is come out with the best resource management decision, and to do that you often do have to hear all the evidence. But in this case, because it's, the problem with the process is that you have to have, the process has to be fair to everybody. So I think the point that the hearings chair was trying to make was, well, actually it means that we have to go back and we have to rehear from people who otherwise may have, if they'd had your submissions, might have made a different submission. And so then that's when it gets complicated, because it's got to be overriding concern. One of the overriding concerns is that it has to be fair to everybody, so everybody has this chance to get heard. And that's why there are strict cut-off rules and that kind of thing. So, because otherwise it would just keep on going around in circles. So, well, I think I've exhausted my questions. It's been a really interesting couple of hours. Anything else anyone wishes to add?
I'd just like to thank you for the informal way that you've run the inquiry.
We have wandered
around a little bit from time to time, but hopefully it was all in the cause of trying to find out the information.
Well, exactly, and it's been, thank you to the council for bearing with me on this as well. I know it has been quite informal, but I think it's actually been really useful to actually be able to and to actually for you to be able to make those points as we've been going through. It's been very helpful. So thank you. Well, I'll officially adjourn the hearing and be in a position to make a decision very soon. Thank you.
Does the commissioner want those two papers there?
No, I can.
Okay.